Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. In the first talk of this wasa, this rains retreat, I talked about the setting of the goals for practicing the meditation on the breath, and introduced the four Ittipadas as one of the important tools, important things to use as you're developing the path. You're developing the meditation on the breath, as you're developing samadhi, and hopefully that you've been keeping in mind those four Ittipadas and keeping them in line with the methodical process of meditating on the breath as a way of letting the coarser aspects of reality subside into nothingness, in order to get this beautiful peace of mind called samadhi. It's a oneness of mind. Again, in the beginning part of this retreat, I will concentrate a lot on just skillful means in order to develop samadhi. And because at the beginning of the retreat, this is really what everyone should be focusing on, developing the mind in peaceful, calm states, aiming for jhana, gaining jhana, and developing these states. But in particular, this evening I wanted to talk about one of the other supporting teachings which assist one developing jhanas in particular, and the path generally, which is the five indriyas, you know, the five powers, controlling faculties, whatever you call them. And it's interesting for those of you who don't know much Pali to understand that the indriyas come from the same root as Indra, as a person who controls, has power. And so these are the things which, like, control or have power over something. In particular, they have power over the mind in order to power it, as it were, along the path, along the Eightfold Path. They give it the oomph in which to walk quickly along the Eightfold Path. There is that sutta which many of you know about the person whose practice is swift and the practice who is slow, and the difference in the swiftness or the slowness of one's practice in gaining these factors of enlightenment. This really depends upon the strength of these indriyas, these five powers or five controlling faculties. If these five controlling faculties are weak, it means the path is slow. If they're strong, it's swift. So these are things which assist the practice of the path. But in particular, this evening I wanted to show how these things can be used in that particular part of the path, called, like, developing the mind in samadhi states, and how these five controlling faculties, like sadha, faith, awirya, energy, sati, mindfulness, and samadhi, sustained attention, and panya, wisdom, how that you should focus on these things in order to overcome the obstacles to deep meditation, in order to really develop the mind and realize the path and the fruits. And that's going to be the subject of this evening's discourse. We begin with something like sadha, with faith or confidence. And as far as the general path is concerned, that confidence, that faith, is about confidence and faith in the Buddha. And the fact there is such a thing called enlightenment, and the Buddha actually knew what he was talking about, and the Buddha would explain things really clearly and really well. And really, one's first faith should be with the Buddha rather than any other monk or teacher or teachings. So one should pay great attention to what the Buddha said and how he said it and why he said it in this way. Because that's a measure of one's faith, one's confidence in the Buddha's teachings. And if what the Buddha said says one thing, or what some teacher says another thing, you should always refer what the Buddha said, having considered these things clearly and carefully. It's a measure of the faith. But also, if one has strong confidence and faith in the Buddha, then one obviously take his advice and his teachings seriously, and one would practice those teachings. It's a measure of the confidence and faith in the Buddha, in what he says, in his enlightenment, and his experiences. The measure of that faith is the amount of energy you put into your practice. Now, if one is a very lax practitioner, one spends a lot of time sleeping or messing around, it really means that you still really haven't got strong faith in what the Buddha said. If you did have strong faith, then you'd do what he said, you'd follow the teachings. It's because sometimes we prefer our own teachings, or prefer the teachings of Mara, that we don't follow the Buddha's teachings. So like faith and confidence in the Buddha's teachings is something which really starts to propel us along the path. But in particular, in the practice of meditation, the Buddha praised again and again, like meditation on the breath. And the confidence in what the Buddha said about the breath meditation should be enough for you to know how important this is and how seriously you should undertake this development of the breath, or rather development of the attention on the breath. And in particular, to develop this breath as far as like jhanas. Because again, the Buddha said again and again that these jhanas, bhavetabhang, they should be developed. So if one really has faith and confidence in the Buddha, then one would follow that advice and develop, to do what it takes to develop these things. It's all part of having confidence. If one has faith and confidence in what the Buddha said, I would look into his teachings and find out how he taught to develop things like jhanas, which is an important part of the Eightfold Path. And you start to see just the things which are necessary. Now, when you have that, the faith that this is important, then you give it the chanda, you give it the necessary amount of will, intention, inclination. But of course, those people who think that these things are unnecessary, or believe with other teachings or teachers, of course their faith will not be complete. You know, their faith will be weakened by doubt or through other opinions. And they will never give it that degree of energy and commitment which is necessary to achieve these things. These things aren't easy to achieve. And the main difficulty is the lack of commitment to them. If one has full commitment to these things, then the major obstacle is taken away. It's just a matter of time. But of course, if one doubts whether they're really necessary or not, then you're putting the major obstacle in your way. The other aspect of siddha or faith, which is very important to each one of you, when we come to the development of these stages, is faith in oneself, as it were. The faith in one's own ability as a person who's attained the human birth. The person who is, for most of you, who have attained to wearing the robes of the Buddha, who are bhikkhus or samaneras. And for those who are anagarikas, anagarikas, or just visiting this monastery, you too have got what it takes. You have all of the necessary ingredients to be able to attain these things. Come yet to find one place in the suttas, the word of the Buddha, where he said that the particular person hadn't got what it takes to attain jhana, that it was impossible for them to attain. It seems that everybody, whether it was someone like Angulimala, who was a serial killer, or Patanjali, Patachara, who was completely mad, that each one of these eventually managed to attain these great states. So there's no serial killers here, there's none that I know about, and there's no one who's crazy and mad to the degree of Patachari, who lost all of her relations, her children, her husband in the same day, and roamed around stark naked. No one is that crazy. So you can know that you have the ability, you can do it. It does happen, and I've seen many monks come and go who believe for one reason or another that they hadn't the ability to gain a jhana or to develop the mind to achieve the paths and fruits. There was something inside of them which said, no, that other people may be, but not me. This actually is a lack of siddha in their own abilities. You can remember that when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, before he actually gained his sambodhi, his full enlightenment, it was Mara came up and tried to shake his confidence, his faith in his abilities, by asking, like, who are you to sit under this Bodhi tree? And the Buddha had to put his hand on the earth and get the earth to bear witness that he was worthy of sitting under that Bodhi tree and becoming enlightened. Each one of you is worthy of sitting in this monastery, developing the mind and gaining full enlightenment. So it's each one of you has the ability. And once you develop that confidence in your own ability, again, it's just a matter of time before it actually happens that these things occur. But there's another aspect of siddha and faith which I haven't talked much about before, these other things you may have heard me speak about before. It is actually the confidence, the faith in the object which you are paying attention to as you develop deep meditation. Because the aspect of faith or confidence, if you've got faith or confidence in a person, you like to be near them and you feel at peace in their presence. In the time when I was a young monk, I couldn't really understand it at first. The first few months I was in Wat Bapong with Ajahn Chah before Wat Banana Chart was founded. You know, we'd do the evening chanting, which would last maybe an hour, just doing chants and then in Pali and then translating them in Thai. I couldn't understand either language. And then there was maybe a talk afterwards, and then maybe a sit of meditation for half an hour. It got to about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and I was ready for bed because we had to get up 3 o'clock in the morning. But then Ajahn Sumedho would say, let's go and see Ajahn Chah. And so we'd just go and sit under his hut for another couple of hours. Again, just listening to things which I couldn't understand. And I wonder, why are people doing this? I'd rather sort of be close to my pillow rather than Ajahn Chah at that time of night. And I was, at least wise enough to try and reflect and try and find out what was the attraction here. People had confidence and faith in this monk, this great teacher. So much so they disliked being with him, hanging out with him, if you like, being close. And they felt great joy of just being around the fellow. And that's actually one of the qualities of confidence and faith in something, that you like to stay around it. There's something which is very close to the word saddha in its meaning, and that's sampasada. Very often it's used in Pali just to be like confidence, almost like pleasure, joy around these things. And this is a very important aspect of faith or confidence, is sampasada. Because once you feel like confidence, a sense of being at ease with things like the breath and eventually the nimitta, then you understand some of the causes for gaining stability in the mind, for gaining samadhi. If you have doubts, say, about Ajahn Chah, then you may go there, listen to a few things, and then you leave again afterwards. If you have faith and confidence, you stay a long time in that place, in that monastery, in that teaching. So you can see that some confidence or faith has a lot to do with stillness, with staying put. So as we start to develop our meditation in these stages, which I taught last week, of like the awareness, the attention to each breath, the continuous attention on the breath, and then the full continuous attention on the breath, the second stage, and then calming down the breath, and eventually rousing the samadhi nimitta. In each of these stages we should remember the quality of sadha, or faith towards that endeavour, the faith towards that object, the sense of like confidence, feeling at ease with the breath, as if it is like an old friend that one feels comfortable with. So one gets this confidence that this is okay, that this is going to lead somewhere, that this is useful, that this is valuable. However, if one, instead of having confidence in the breath, one has confidence and faith in thinking and working everything out, then you'll find the mind will wander off into thoughts, fantasies, into evaluations. It's all because the sadha is there, but it's in the wrong things. So it's good to have like confidence in the method and confidence in the meditation object. Sometimes this might sound strange at first on something like the breath, but when it comes to the very beautiful breath and eventually the samadhi nimitta, this quality of sampasada becomes very important, because eventually you start to go to areas where you've never been before, experiences which are strange, and fear is one of the obstacles which comes up. What's happening, as I've mentioned before, that it's the fear of like letting go of the self, or letting go of the illusion of the self. The self is comfortable in the known, where it's always lived before. However, when it gets to things which it's not quite sure of, especially when it thinks it can't really control and keep power over these things, when it has to let go, when these things are greater than the sense of self doing control, that's when fear arises. And this is where it's important to develop this faith. This faith in the Buddha's teachings that jhanas are okay. They don't need to be feared. Nabhayitabhan, the Buddha kept on saying with deep samadhi, with jhanas. They shouldn't be feared. Which is okay to say that, but how can we overcome the fear which can often block entering these stages? You overcome that fear through many causes, but one of the causes is through sampasadana, through that confidence. Confidence in the beautiful breath, first of all. This is alright, it's a beautiful place to be. It's alright to be here, it's a place where there's no need to feel fear. Where you can actually hang out there, you can rest in there. One of the things which made faith in Ajahn Chah so easy is very soon you understood at a deep level, through the power of his metta, loving kindness, that he would never do anything to harm or hurt you. Even though that superficially he could sort of say something which embarrassed you, or he could make life very difficult for you, he always had the feeling that he was doing it in your best interests, that it was going to be valuable for you, useful for you, beneficial for you. That's one of the reasons why you had confidence and faith in him, why you didn't leave, why you stuck around, even when it was difficult. In the same way that if the breath is difficult, you know, even if it's giving you a little bit of a hard time, if you have like confidence and faith in this thing, you'll stick around. You realize that this thing is in your best interest. That when the beautiful breath comes up, it's in your best interest to stick around this thing. And so the confidence in this abiding makes it appear to be a safe abiding. An abiding where there's no need for fear, where fear can't come up. And when the samadhi nimitta appears, that's where, like, confidence is also very important. Now, that confidence that this thing which first comes up as a mental image, it's just too easy to have doubt about this. Now, is this the samadhi nimitta, or is it just my imagination, or is it someone shining a flashlight in my face, or what actually is it? And this is where, like, confidence is very important, because so often if a doubt comes up, this can't be it, then the whole thing just breaks apart and disappears. You have confidence and belief in these things. Skillful meditators can just imagine the samadhi nimitta. And as soon as they imagine, once they know what it is, what they're supposed to imagine through experience, they can imagine the samadhi nimitta, and the imagination becomes a real samadhi nimitta. Someone told me some time ago in town, there was one person, a lay person, teaching other people to meditate on the breath. And people had much experience of breath meditation. They found it difficult to meditate on the breath. And so this teacher used a very skillful technique. He said, just imagine you can watch the breath. You don't really need to do it, just imagine you can. And so they found it very easy to imagine that they're watching the breath. And then they said, what's the difference between imagining you're watching the breath and in watching the breath? And they found there was no difference. It's just the trick of psychology. Because imagination is just an image in the mind. And this is actually what you're supposed to be developing anyway. Imagine you can get a samadhi nimitta, and then you're 90% there. And if you can have confidence in that image, then it will stay there. I think one of the difficulties with anyone who tries any type of visualization especially, is they haven't got any confidence in what they visualize, and just got too much doubting in their mind, which is why the whole thing just breaks apart. If you can have confidence in that, sampasadana, you know, the faith in it, sadhara in it, and you find it will stay and it will develop. So when these things start to appear, it's good to develop the indriya of, like, confidence in what's going on, like faith in what's going on, the trust in what's going on, valuing what's going on, all these qualities of faith. And then eventually the mind will feel at ease with the beautiful breath. It will feel at ease with the samadhi nimitta. When it feels at ease with these things, it doesn't destroy it. You destroy the samadhi nimitta when it appears. You throw it away, you move away from it, because of your lack of confidence in it. It's one of the reasons why I try and encourage just any type of experience of jhana, even for a few seconds, a few moments, just so people get to understand what it feels like, even for a short moment. Because once you do that, that does a great deal for your confidence, one, in your ability, and two, in the fact that this is a beautiful abiding, and very safe, and very worthwhile. There's nothing to be feared. So that's why that one should try and develop the confidence and faith in something like a samadhi nimitta. And eventually, even in the first jhana that I just elaborating on this quality of sampasadana, or sampasada rather, that this quality of sampasada, even in the first jhana, that is not full yet, the sense of confidence and faith in the piti sukha, which becomes the nimitta, the mental nimitta. And that's why that this vitaka vichara going on, just that not from you, not from a person, certainly not thought, but just the mind just moving on to the object, grasping it a little bit too hard, which is why it just moves away again. It hasn't got the confidence just to rest on the object, the nimitta, and attain to the second jhana. The mind is always doing it. It doesn't realize it just needs to let go, have faith, have confidence, that things will just go by themselves in a natural process. Samadhi nimitta, the piti sukha, is just so beautiful, so attractive. The attention will stay there by itself. It doesn't need to be so coarse is to have this vitaka vichara, trying to hold on to a samadhi nimitta. So once you have that confidence, that's what makes vitaka vichara of the first jhana just disappear. Because the mind is with the nimitta, with the piti sukha. That's why that word samprasada comes up in the second jhana. Ajatang samprasadanang, the standard description of the second jhana. There's the full confidence inside, in the mind, in the piti sukha of the mind. It's only then can you really get samadhi, the full samadhi which first appears in the second jhana, true one-pointedness, true stillness, true release of this activity of mind. That which does ceases at that point. And you just got the experience, the consciousness very clear and bright. So this needs the samprasadana. It's all part of sadha, confidence and faith. That's why it's a power, because it's just so powerful, so important in order for you to gain these stages. Very often you see that great teachers arise from time to time, or at least they arise with great reputations. Some of them turn out to be shooting stars who just last for a short while and then decline. Some just last for a long time, true great teachers. And because of people's confidence in them, it's amazing just how they develop their mind, and whether it's people like Pao Ok Sayadaw in Burma, or even Amata Gawesi when he was teaching in Sri Lanka, and any other great teachers. That sometimes these people, because of your faith and confidence in them, you would just go so much further. So this is why that sadha is an indriya. So just to sum up on that particular indriya, that particular controlling faculty, just generally that develop your sadha, your faith in the Buddha's teachings, and follow them very carefully. They're beautiful. No one has ever expressed the Dharma as beautifully as the Buddha, and no one will ever manage to match the Buddha in the way he expressed those teachings. And have that confidence in the path, confidence enough to follow it methodically, carefully, not going off on sidetracks. And have confidence in your own ability, and also have confidence in the breath, especially the beautiful breath, and confidence in the samadhi nimitta. What you're having confidence in is confidence in letting go, confidence in a partial cessation, and confidence that this is the path, this practicing the path. So that's only the first of the indriyas, which is important, and especially I like to just emphasize their importance in developing deep meditation. There's always the virya as well, so the energy. Sometimes that one of the monks here, I'm grateful for pointing out something which I'd been taught and just took for granted, that sometimes people say that these five indriyas should be balanced with one another. But actually when you understand what these indriyas truly are, that's not the right way of putting it, balancing them. That actually comes from the Visuddhimagga, from the commentary. Nothing about that at all, really, in the suttas. Now, sadha, you don't need to... It's not a question of having too much sadha. You can't have too much faith and confidence. You can only have it in the wrong things. But the quality itself, you can just build it up as much as you like. The more the better. There can't be too much confidence and faith in the Buddha's teaching. Confidence in one's own abilities, confidence in the nimitta. Can't be too much of that. And say with energy, if one really understands what energy is, there can't be too much of it. Because actually the way they express virya in terms of the five indriyas, I was just checking this just before I came in here, it is just the four right efforts. That's what in terms of the indriyas, what virya is, the four right efforts, is to grab hold of the mind, strive, initiate energy, develop striving in four areas. The four areas are to abandon unwholesome states of mind which have arisen, and to prevent unwholesome states from arising in the first part, in the first place. Those are the first two of the four right efforts. To arouse, develop wholesome states of mind. And once those wholesome states are there, to make them grow, to keep them there for a long time. That's the four right efforts, which is what the Wirya Indriya is all about. So you can't do that too much. In fact, it's because of doing it too little that people don't develop the mind and don't attain what needs to be attained. Or sometimes because they think they should just sit there and do nothing. Now, being mindful is not enough. When you're mindful, there's a consequence to that. There's a responsibility of being mindful. Once you're mindful and you know an unwholesome state of mind coming up, you should do something about it. Even when there's not an unwholesome state there, you should sort of prevent them arising and also develop good state. This is like what the Wirya is all about. That's why that a lot of Wirya is developed through the four Iddhipadas, through having an aspiration and through having some knowledge, some samadhiti, lokiya samadhiti, which is knowing the difference between wholesome states and unwholesome states of mind. So this is an important aspect of the Indriyas, to develop energy in the sense of the four right efforts, and to keep those four right efforts in mind. If there's ever an unwholesome state of mind, whether it's lust or whether it's anger, it's always doing something about it, not just leaving it there. Not leaving it there to grow and fester and become a great sickness of the mind. So the energy is all about developing four right efforts. And you can't do that enough. So there's no question of like balancing in the sense of a balance when one thing is too heavy. You have to throw a bit away to make it even with what's on the other side of the scales. It's always building up each one of these things as much as you can. So when there's Wirya, you develop as much four right efforts as you possibly can, whether it's sleepiness, sloth and torpor. Find ways of abandoning those unwholesome states of mind, whether it's lust. Find ways of abandoning those unwholesome states of mind, whether it's anger, ill will. Find ways of abandoning those unwholesome states of mind. It does take mindfulness, because one of the best ways of abandoning these things, unwholesome states of mind, is to see them as soon as they come up. Have mindfulness so sharp that as soon as they can come up, you can throw them away. It's why in like meditation, in the last 9-day meditation retreat I gave like a simile of mindfulness. Of mindfulness especially towards the obstacles to one's meditation. I just gave a simile of like, again, the first years I was in Thailand. In the monastery there were many snakes, scorpions, centipedes, and these things would bite, at least the scorpions and centipedes would. You had to be very careful of these things. Because you knew how dangerous they were, after the evening meeting, when you walk back, and sometimes you walk back without any sandals, you walk barefoot, and the flashlights you had, they were always low on batteries. Sometimes you didn't have any batteries. Sometimes Ajahn Chah would give you batteries and say that's all you get for 3 months. So you really had to make sure they lasted. So, but because you knew there were all these things out there which would cause you great pain, you were really alert as you walked back for snakes, for not so much for scorpions and centipedes. They didn't really sort of come out so much at night. They were actually in your hut, you had to be careful of them, not in the path. Also the black ants, those who've been in Thailand, the Mot Lin. Always very aware of those. I remember stepping in them once and my flashlight went right up in the air because I jumped. was in a terrible situation because it was pitch black. There was these mottling all over the place, the biting ants, and they stung. And I didn't know where my flashlight was. Those people who've been in Thailand can appreciate those experiences. It happens very often. Anyhow, but because that these things were dangerous, you were always alert for them, and you'd always see them before you stepped on them, or you'd always be able to walk around them, because you knew they were there and you were alert to the danger. In the same way, like the mindfulness, which can become a controlling faculty in one's meditation, it's like setting yourself up when you begin. What are my obstacles to meditation? What is my snakes, my scorpions, my centipedes? What should I be really alert to so I don't waste my time, waste my opportunity? Is it sloth and torpor, which is my greatest enemy? Is it restlessness and thinking? Or is it lust or whatever? Once you know what your snake is, then as soon as you start meditating, you psych yourself up to be aware of this thing, to watch out for it, just when it first pops its head out of the side of the path. You've got to see it then. Once you've stepped on the snake, it's too late. Once it's bit you, and snakes move very fast. One of the monks in Thailand walked down from his hut, and he saw a snake at the bottom of his stairs. He'd already just walked past. He didn't see its head move and bite him. Only afterwards, he just looked at his ankle and saw the puncture marks. It was that fast, faster than he could see. That's how dangerous snakes are. Very fast. But defilements are even faster. You have to be really alert for these things. They can just creep up on you and catch you. That's the sort of mindfulness you need in meditation. And it's not that hard to develop. If you know this simile of like snakes, scorpions and centipedes, and you begin your meditation by saying, I'm going to walk on a dangerous path, what are my obstacles? And once you psych yourself up that way, the first time that, say, sloth and torpor starts to rear its head, you see it, and you say no, and you go in a different direction. That's the great way of overcoming sloth and torpor in one's meditation. By one, knowing it's a danger, setting the mindfulness up to which remembers this is the one I've got to look out for in my meditation, and then you catch it early. And then you can use wirya in terms of four right efforts to abandon that state of mind. Walk in a different direction. Don't get lost. Sloth and torpor is like the python, it just strangles you. Once it's got around your leg, you just can't do anything about it. It's squeezing you, squashed it, you're in trouble. It's much easier to avoid sort of allowing it to get close. And that's one of the great things with mindfulness in the beginning stages of one's meditation. It makes you avoid just your old obstacle. And once you avoid the coarser obstacles, you can know how to avoid the more fine obstacles. By setting up mindfulness. Remember that half of mindfulness is memory. It's remembering what you're supposed to be doing, what your obstacles are, like learning from past mistakes in one's meditation, so we can make great progress. It's why that I teach in town, at the end of every meditation, you should just spend a few moments just assessing where you've got to and why you've got there. What's happened in the half hour, hour, hour and a half, 2 hours you'd be meditating, and why? And as you sit there at the end of your meditation assessing sort of what's happened and where you are, it's just reflective knowledge, touch awaken the jhana, just reflecting back on what's happened. And you bear that in mind for the next time. So that which caused good states of mind, you know what those causes are. Those causes which gave rise to unwholesome states of mind, which wasted your time. You know what those are. By knowing this, you can take that into your next meditation. Especially by just reminding yourself at the beginning of I got lost in this particular area time and time again. For this meditation, this is my snake. I'm going to really avoid that particular obstacle. And you find, if you set yourself up at the beginning of the meditation, through the knowledge you've gained in past meditation, it's not that hard to avoid these things. As soon as they come up, you can squash them straight away. You can jump over them, you can avoid them, whatever it takes. But you don't get caught in the traps. So that's the sati, the mindfulness, the memory, sort of indriya, which can really help the development of deep meditation. The other half of the sati is like mindfulness. There has to be attention which is completely centered in the present moment. That's the only way that you can develop attention on the beautiful breath and maintain it there. It's the only way you can develop the full attention on the samadhi nimitta and enter into a jhana. All the perceptions of past and future have to be overcome, have to be abandoned. Remember that perception of past and future can be very subtle, even as much as what should I do next. Straight away you're off in the future. Or just, what was that? Just in the past. Each one of those things, you know, what was that? You should not do that until the very end of your meditation. Especially when you start getting samadhi nimittas coming up, don't try and assess them with what was that. Sometimes we call it what is that, but the truth of the matter is what was that? Because thought, assessment, happens just after the experience has been sensed. And that's just going to the past again. That's where the meditation breaks apart. The sati, the mindfulness, has to be so firmly established in the present moment that thoughts can't come up. Assessments are just put on hold until later on. To the point that when you enter a jhana, at that time you just can't assess it. Because you're so focused in the present moment, there's just no room to make sense of it, to assess it. You've just got pure data coming in. There's no evaluation possible. Mindfulness should be that focused on the present moment. The other problem which sometimes comes up with a samadhi nimitta, what should I do now? The point being that you've already done the right things, you're doing the right things, because the samadhi nimitta is there. Leave it alone. Stop interfering. Very often you'll find that the meditation will go so far and will break down, will shatter because of what should I do next type of intentions. Be careful of that one. That's the mindfulness not being centered in the present moment. And of course the samadhi indriya is one of the most beautiful of the indriyas. It generally means just attaining the four jhanas. But in particular, in one of these suttas which I really like, and I've mentioned before, they said like the definition of the samadhi indriya, I think it's in the Anguttara somewhere, it must be the Anguttara Fives. The definition was in the Sanghita. I think it might be actually in the Sanghita. But anyway, the samadhi indriya, and defining it, they were saying that it's a lot to do with developing the wasaga ramana, the aramana, the mood, inclination of mind, if you like, state of mind, of like abandoning, giving up. And samadhi is all about letting go. That's sometimes why I keep on saying that jhanas are just stages of letting go. And it's interesting just to see the development of the samadhi indriya being brought about through just developing a mind which is willing just to give away, let go, wasagga, wasagga, abandoning. Because to develop like samadhi, you have to abandon just so much. The development of the samadhi indriya means you You just sit in your room. You abandon all of your concerns. You abandon all of your body. You abandon all of your thoughts. All of these disturbances, these weights on the mind. Just throw away as much as you can. Throw away, throw away, throw away. The more you throw away, the more the mind is pure. Because all of these things are just defilements which you've collected over the years. And so once you understand that the way into deep samadhi is a way of letting go, a way of abandoning, then it becomes a very easy path. Not a sense of like holding on to something, but a sense of letting go of everything else. So when you develop the meditation on the breath, it's a lot of letting go of every other concern. All I need to do is just to watch the breath. Develop the letting go of everything else until all you've got left is the breath. That second stage I keep talking about, the full continuous awareness of the breath. You watch it from the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, the very beginning of the next out-breath to the end of the next out-breath. Breath after breath after breath. Having developed that just through letting go of everything else in the whole world, you've got no other responsibilities, just to watch the breath. No responsibilities for your body, for scratching it, for getting rid of the pain or the discomfort or whatever. That's all gone because you've abandoned all of that. No responsibility for your family, for your other duties in the monastery. You've abandoned all of that. This is the skill of abandoning. So you've just got the breath left. But of course the abandoning doesn't stop there. You just abandon the coarse breath. So you've just got the beautiful breath. Then you abandon the beautiful breath. So you've just got the samadhi nimitta. Then you even abandon the samadhi nimitta. You abandon everything. You enter into jhanas. All of these things. Just give up. Give away. As much as you can. And that's how you develop the samadhi indriya. But in particular, the reason why it's called an indriya is because it has a function of just keeping the mind still. Of sustaining attention. And this is like the tool which is just so important in understanding the Dhamma, to be able to keep the attention still on the object of contemplation. I mentioned so often that because that life is like sitting in a bus, just watching all of these images pass by just so quickly, that we never actually get to understand anything very much. Just, you know, if you are in a bus, like people go on these tours of Europe, 10 countries in 5 days. You just go so fast. You never really get to know any country or any landscape. Even if you walk, you're still going too fast. Even if you sit down and watch, you're still going too fast. Even if you think, you're still going too fast. You've got to slow down that much. You can sustain your attention just on one mental object for many hours. That's when you start to understand the mind. Otherwise the mind just flashes past. You never really can make head nor tail of it, what it is. Once you have samadhi, you understand the stillness of the mind. How it can take one object without the object changing, even an iota, for a long, long time. You understand the cause of this is the bliss, the joy of it, the peace of it. It is the cause for sustaining attention. It's sukha. Not the core sukha, but just the inner sukha, the inner happiness, which is the foundation of samadhi, the ability to sustain attention. So once you know that, you understand just how the mind can sustain its attention on something. The perception of the beautiful on the breath. Eventually the perception of the beautiful on whatever object you take up for contemplation. Enough so that you can remain with it long enough to find its true nature. But it's hard to do this. You have to develop the mind. That's why samadhi is the last factor of the Eightfold Path. In the Anguttara Nikaya, they add an extra couple of factors on. After Samma Samadhi is Samma Jnana, if I remember it correctly. Like right wisdom. Nata Samanyana Sama Vimuti, the right release. It's all following after one another. You have to develop that ability to sustain attention on something. Really sustain it. Be absolutely still while you're watching. Suspending judgment, but just taking in the data. No evaluation yet. If you're evaluating, you're missing watching. And this becomes like the Samadindriya, the beautiful power of the mind. And the last of the indriyas is panya, wisdom, which is basically like knowing things like Four Noble Truths, the Ten Origination, three characteristics. Know the nature of the khandhas, know the nature of your body and mind, the senses. Just to know them as they truly are, not as you've been taught that they are, not as you hope and wish that they are, but to know them as they are, which is beyond your likes and dislikes, beyond your preconceptions, beyond your theories. It's a very hard thing to develop panya. You do it through all these other things. I should have just mentioned that sometimes that people say that samadhi and virya should be balanced together. And that's not really true. Just develop samadhi as much as you like. Keep on developing virya as much as you like, sati as much as you like. Bring them all up as much as you like. If one is very, very strong, you make that stronger. You bring all the other ones up with it. You develop a lot of samadhi, sati and virya and sada, they'll all come along in its wake. Because all these things are just so connected. If you develop very deep samadhi, gain jhanas, then you have to have extremely strong sati after you emerge from a jhana. As far as your sada, confidence in the Buddha is concerned, and the confidence in the teacher as well, it's common for anyone who sort of gets even a whiff of a jhana, they have this beautiful like confidence in whoever taught them how to meditate, and great joy and happiness and just wanting to do something for them. That's just the nature of it. One of the first teachers who taught me about meditation, and to this day he's only a lay person. If I met him now, I just want to bow to him or do something, give him something, wash his trousers because he hasn't got a robe or something, because of, you know, the debt of gratitude you have to anyone who sort of gave you something of this beautiful gift. So all of these faculties, they bring one another up. And same with panya, with wisdom. It's a very powerful indriya, one of the most powerful, especially as you are developing deep meditation. You know, when you're developing the breath, you cannot do this without wisdom. I think it's the Buddha said somewhere that the breath meditation is for people with wisdom. If you've got like weak wisdom, it's very difficult to take it to its limits. And the reason is because you have to know the different forms of the breath. I mean, it took years for me to understand that there's a great confusion between the samadhi nimitta and the breath. And what should I be watching? Because I'm supposed to be doing anapanasati, meditation on the breath. But as soon as the samadhi nimitta came up, and you're watching that, there was no breath. And so, what was going on here? Should I go back to the breath, or should I carry on with the samadhi nimitta? And eventually, the sort of the wisdom came up. Hang on, what is this samadhi nimitta? The samadhi nimitta is no more than the way the mind sees the breath. It is the breath. Instead of like experiencing the breath through the kaya vijnana, you know, the bodily sense, you're seeing it through the mano vijnana, through the mind sense. It's the same thing being experienced, but through a different sense base. So actually, I was still observing the breath. And even in jhanas, you're actually still observing the breath. But just that, such a beautiful, refined aspect of the breath. You know, just a fraction of the breath, just its beauty without the breath being discerned. Without the other causal aspects of the breath being discerned. This is what was happening. And so it took that wisdom which gave me the confidence to follow this samadhi nimitta. It's happening naturally anyway, but I wanted to sort of have confidence it was going in the right direction and I was doing it right. And so that the panya, the wisdom of knowing knowing sort of the what's happening and knowing the stages. There's only really one way into jhanas. There's many objects you can use, but the way is just finding an object to focus your attention on, and it's using one of the external sense bases first of all, and just letting go of everything else and just keeping that one thing in mind until all you've got left is just that one thing, whether it's metta, whether it's the earth kasina, whether it's the breath or whatever, until like the physical sense experience disappears and just the mind experience comes up. It's just the nature of the mind experience on just one thing. It's just beautiful. It's the happiness of peace. It's the vivekaja piti sukha, the happiness born of renunciation of the other five senses. It's just the nature of body mind to do that. As soon as the external five senses disappear and the mind is just there, it appears like pure, bright, beautiful, lovely. So how actually you get to that stage is just by the way. But once actually you know just how this whole thing works, then just whatever the object of meditation, you know the path, how to use it. It's like the wisdom of how to develop the renunciation of the mind and enter into a jhanas. So all along the way, as one develops deep meditation, one has to use one's wisdom and develop more wisdom. Even I was saying the difficulties and obstacles of meditation, you know, use your wisdom to know what those are, especially at the end of the meditation, just to reflect backwards what happened, what occurred, what were the obstacles, was I successful, was I not successful in my goal, why? Learn. And as you go along, use that panya. It's a very powerful force. Very often in my own meditation, sometimes I get an obstacle to deep meditation. And I just use very often more like wisdom rather than willpower. So always got confidence that this can be done at any time. Actually, that sometimes I played around, and amazing just how the confidence in one's abilities to enter these states in all sorts of situations just increases. You know, I mentioned last week about getting to deep meditation when I was in hospital with typhus fever. I just gave it a chance. I didn't really have much confidence it could be done, but you could do it. Amazing just what the mind can do. Even sometimes when you're tired, some of the most unlikely situations, you know, you can actually gain access to these states. It's amazing just what the mind can do. But anyhow, just the wisdom, the panya, just can grow enormously as a result of these experiences. So the wisdom is a great help, but especially there's a few things which I always use, which is like anatta sanya, just remembering like non-self as you enter these deep meditation states. There's the wisdom of just messing around with these things. If I try dukkha sanya, the perception of suffering, then there's no way you can enter a jhana with that perception. That perception is true, okay. It's more true than the supa sanya or the sukha sanya, which is what takes you into jhanas, the perception of like joy and happiness. But nevertheless, that the path requires you to not pay attention to the aspect of dukkha, nor pay attention to the aspect of anicca, of impermanence in these states. You can bring up those perceptions afterwards. But to enter into a jhana, you need to have the perception of stability, the perception of happiness, but also the perception of anatta, of non-self, especially the doer. If you can always remember as you get to these final stages before you enter into jhana, it's not self, it's not a doer in here. So you're willing to let go of this doer which causes a restlessness. that which does, that which has always tried to keep control of all of this. If you have the wisdom to just develop a little bit of anatta-sanya, you find the meditation goes so quickly, so powerfully, so deeply. It's just a process, it's a natural process. That's also why I say that you can have confidence, you can do it. There's no one in there which can't do it. It's a natural process if you just follow the instructions, just like in any manual. Just follow the instructions, this is how you assemble it, put it all together. If you follow the instructions that the book says, it usually works. Very rarely you just get a fault from the manufacturer. It usually always works. Because most of the time it doesn't work because people don't follow the instructions. So that confidence comes up. But also the other bit of wisdom is like making sure that the mindfulness is always in the present moment. Those are the two things which sometimes I forget, and not to put the attention right in the present moment, and sometimes forget just to leave things alone. Anatta, there's no one in there, so stop this illusion of thinking you're in control of all of this and always doing it. You don't do meditation, you just observe meditation happening. You just observe the mind doing the things. It's not to say there's no will happening, there's no choice happening, but you just realize you're not doing it. And so when it's the time for the process to be quiet and for nothing to happen and just to enter into deep dhyana, you're ready to allow that to happen. Instead of always thinking you have to be calling the shots and pushing the buttons and pulling the levers all the time. So the panya indriya becomes very strong. The more you understand anatta, non-self, the easier jhanas become. The easier jhanas become, the more you understand anatta. As the two go together. The panya indriya and the samadhi indriya are very close together. So there's not things like balancing these things, but actually supporting one another. And the stronger each one is, the stronger the others become. And the panya indriya especially eventually being so strong that it sort of defeats all the defilements. Eventually each of these indriyas becomes so strong they do really become balas, full powers. When they're full powers, that's the stuff of the arahat. The full power, the absolute faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Arya Sangha. Not even a shadow of a doubt, because you've experienced all of these things. You know jhanas, you know cessation, you know the dukkha, the truths, you know nibbana. Nibbana doesn't become a theory which people argue about. Nibbana becomes a knowledge. Wirya, energy, just becomes a natural faculty of the mind, because there's nothing obstructing it. There's only wholesome dhammas can arise in the mind. Unwholesome dhammas have been abandoned once and for all. There's sati, mindfulness is pure and constant, fully powerful. And samadhi, the four jhanas, easily obtained. That's the bala of samadhi. That's where the indriya of samadhi is fulfilled. Becomes a bala, a great strength. Anyone who, you know, bala, like the strength of a strong man, anyone who has experienced any of these stages know how strong, like, full confidence is. How it empowers you, energy, how it empowers you, like, full mindfulness. Not partial mindfulness, but full mindfulness, how powerful it feels. How powerful is samadhi. And lastly, how powerful is wisdom. Knowing the ways of the mind and the body, knowing fully, continually, in every moment, anicca, dukkha, anatta. You can know in every moment, anicca, dukkha, anatta, then that's an arahat. The quality of the enlightened mind, the continual knowing of anicca, dukkha, anatta, full wisdom. Now that's powerful, that's immense. Powerful because completely eradicated suffering, completely defeated Maras and all his armies, completely defeated the round of rebirth. That's the power, the great power of Nibbana. So these are the five hindrances. Those are the five hindrances, the five indriyas, and how they can be developed, and especially how you should use those in developing deep meditation, as well as the four idipadas. Look on the five indriyas: confidence, energy, or the four right efforts, mindfulness, sustained attention, and wisdom. These are means to help you develop deep meditation. So that's the talk for this evening. Has anyone got any questions or comments? Okay.